I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 29th of October. Thomas Cahill has a new book he adds to his series, Hinges of History. This is the sixth of the projected seven-volume series. This one is Heretics and Heroes, How Renaissance Artists and Reformation Priests Created Our World. I love what he says about the hinges of history. We normally think of history as one catastrophe after another, war followed by war, outrage by outrage, almost as if history were nothing more than all the narratives of human pain assembled in sequence. And surely this is often enough. An adequate description, but history is also the narratives of grace, the recountings of those blessed and inexplicable moments when someone did something for someone else, saved a life, bestowed a gift, gave something beyond what was required by circumstance. You'll remember some of the other titles in his series, How the Irish Saved Civilization, The Gifts of the Jews, Desire of the Everlasting Hills, Sailing the Wine Dark Sea, Mysteries of the Middle Ages, all have been bestsellers all over the world. He's going to be in Milwaukee in November. We'll tell you about that. He has taught at Queens College, Fordham University, Seton Hall. He was once the North American education correspondent for the Times of London and for many years was a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Times Book Review. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Thomas. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thomas, hello. Thank you so much for the book. It's just terrific.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I'm very happy to be here.
Before we delve right into Michelangelo, who I have to start with first, I would just want to talk about how in the world did you learn all of this? I mean, I was reading the book and I'm thinking, what a body of work you've done here. I just can't imagine knowing the whole of Western civilization, which is essentially what you've done.
Well, yes and no. You know, there are a lot longer volumes than mine. There are a lot more detailed versions of these histories. What I really wanted to do was to answer the question, how did we become the people that we are?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we think and feel the way we do? Which is different from other civilizations. There's no getting around that. Western history is highly characteristic. And at this moment, many other civilizations are intensely interested in how we became the people that we are. I will tell you that among my biggest fans are the Chinese and the Japanese.
Really? Why?
Well, I mean, I don't know the answer. I just know what the sales are like.
Huh.
And I think it has to do with their looking for a key to understanding the larger world, which is in many ways now, which in many ways bears the imprint of the West, for, if you like, for better and for worse, but there it is. I would say largely for better, though not entirely. These far Eastern civilizations really grew in a very, very different way. Long ago, I realized that we are a processive civilization. That is to say, we tell stories to one another about going from one place to another. Just and the granddaddy of all those stories is the story of Abraham, who is asked by God to go from one place to another and become a different kind of human being and build a different kind of culture. One that welcomes change and that looks forward to what comes next rather than fearing what comes next.
Mm-hmm.
All other civilizations were basically cyclical. Summer, fall, winter, spring, birth, copulation, death, over and over again. We are the first and basically only processive civilization.
Mm. And you start the book, actually, with you make it a tennis game, really. And maybe there were tennis games but back in Greece. I don't know. But you
probably not.
Oh, I like to think of it that way. But you start with certain key figures and their conversations, their arguments are ones that will reappear centuries later. So you start the book with Plato and Aristotle
having a tennis match.
Right.
Yeah. And then several centuries later, because they keep playing for a very long time, they're joined by two medieval Christian theologians, Plato by St. Augustine or St. Augustine. Augustine was nuts about Plato, to put it plainly. He was a true Platonist. Aristotle, who was much more earthy than Plato, who is very lofty, Aristotle is joined by Thomas Aquinas, and Aquinas was very definitely an Aristotelian, not a Platonist.
Mm-hmm.
And those two forces, or if you call maybe two double forces, have an awful lot to do with who we are today and how we got to be who we are and how we think the way we do about the world. Right now, I would say Aristotle and Aquinas are winning. the current part of the tennis match.
But it's a conversation that we keep repeating, which essentially is about the loftiest of all topics, which is the nature of reality.
Exactly. Right. Right. What is really real is mm-hmm. the question. And they give different answers. For Plato, the real is off somewhere. It's not here. We're just pale reflections of the real. And for Aristotle and Aquinas, we're real.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I would say that, you know, it's the Aristotelian scientific form that is winning now.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. When you look at this, this must have been, I don't know, you've done so many of these, and my background is Irish, so I love the book about how the Irish saved civilization, but there's something about how the...
Kathleen Dunn is an Irish name?
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea.
Thomas Cahill might be, too,
I'm
huh?
kidding.
Yeah, I know. I know. But there's something about, and I was pouring through the pictures and showing my office mates, I'm so glad they're in the book, this particular time, this Renaissance, all of these figures, you know, Michelangelo and Martin Luther and Columbus and Da Vinci and all of these people who you could just, our souls are so attracted to them, and they were incredible human beings, weren't they?
Yeah, well, they weren't all wonderful. For instance, Columbus is not a wonderful person.
No.
Not by a long stretch. But he's a big figure. And that's one of the things that happens in this period.
Mm-hmm.
I say somewhere in the book, this is the first period in which there could have been a People magazine. It wouldn't have worked in earlier eras, but it would have worked here. The individual becomes much more important than he had ever been before, and all individuals become much more important, so that people we never heard of and never will hear about put more value on their individual selves than they had in earlier eras. So it's one of the parts of becoming who we are. I mean, we can't get away from it now. I mean,
mm-hmm.
We couldn't possibly in a million years. But when Martin Luther says, I cannot go back on what I've said mm-hmm. because it's my conscience and I have to be true to my conscience, that's an enormous moment in history. No one had ever said anything quite like that before. This little guy, this unknown monk, and he's standing before an audience of his betters, of the people who run the empire and the church,
mm-hmm.
and he says, no.
mm-hmm.
That's brand new.
And you say at some point in the book that they had to rally all of their forces. They realized what a big thing this was that he had done. All of their, you know, public relations forces and take him on full force because they saw the enormity of what he had done.
Yeah. Well, they did, and they knew as well as he did, in a way, what was going on in that funny little room. where they were all crowded in to hear what he had to say. And I think there was not only shock, but there was a realization, even by the people right there hearing it for the first time, that there's something historic going on here.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk then a little bit more about religion. There are several themes about the corruption of the church that runs through so many of these times, and of course the persecution of Jews, which is so rampant all through history, but they're blamed for everything. I think for the bubonic plague at the beginning of your book, which happened prior to this time period, the role of religion, well, it doesn't seem to be a force for good very often, does it?
Well, in the book before this, Mysteries of the Middle Ages, I show some very positive things about religion, about Christianity in particular, and how it improved the civilization. By this point, however, you have the inevitable corruption, I think. You know, there's no institution that human beings have ever created that has not been subject not only to occasional corruption, but immense and devastating corruption. And that's certainly true of the Catholic Church in this period. You know, the business about indulgences is just a scam,
mm-hmm.
created by the church in order to bring in wealth. And we shouldn't be so surprised. It doesn't make them very different from the American bankers who almost brought down American civilization very
yes.
recently as 2008. People, whether they're clergy or whoever they are likely sooner or later to bend to the corruption of the majority. And that's what happens here.
Mm-hmm. Why do you spend a lot of time, before the Renaissance, I guess you would say, with the bubonic plague? Was there something about the loss
really,
of life? Yeah, why did you start there?
It really changed everything.
Mm.
It's the end of the era of Francis of Assisi and Giotto and people like that, who were very gentle figures, very sweet almost, because what really happens in this period is perhaps as much as half of Europe died.
Goodness.
That's annoying. Can you imagine something like that happening?
Mm.
So one morning, the people who are still left wake up and say, gee, there's almost no one here. My neighbor's fields, since he's dead and his whole family is dead, they're kind of going to seed. Why don't I just take them over? You have a lot of realignments of wealth in this period. And whereas in the Middle Ages, you had people kind of obedient, you know, the serf saying, well, I'm just a serf, that's what I am, I live and die a serf. You have people saying in this period, I'm not a serf, I'm going to do what I want. And and if you need my help, you can pay for it.
They're all...
you have the beginnings of what we still think of as capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
People and individuals as their own sales force, as it were, you know. Yeah, I'm happy to help you. Let me show you what my bill will be. You know.
Right.
No. Oh, you're the Lord? You think you're gonna order me around? That's all over. Well, of course there's a lot of fighting over just that, but in the end, of course, it's the serfs who win and the lords who lose.
Mm-hmm. Thomas Cahill is our guest this hour. His sixth in the series, Hinges of History, has just been published, Heretics and Heroes, How Renaissance Artists and Reformation Priests Created Our World, and it's filled with the Renaissance and the time right before the Renaissance. Most of it is truly glorious. Some of it, of course, is disturbing, as life is. But when you think of the the grand human beings who came from this time period, it's truly remarkable. And we'll talk about more of them as we continue our conversation. I would imagine that some of you, well, I hope you've had a chance to read this. It's just been published, but he's also author of How the Irish Saved Civilization, The Gifts of the Jews, Desire of the Everlasting Hills, Sailing the Wine Dark Sea, and Mysteries of the Middle Ages. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We should also tell you that Thomas is going to be in Milwaukee at Boswell Books, and that's going to be on November the 7th. Boswell Books, it's an event that's free and open to the public, and it's at 7 o'clock. What a grand night of conversation that will be. This is, call us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, we are going to be talking with Jack Mitchell, who really founded the Ideas Network and the marvelous thing that it is all over the state of Wisconsin with a reach far beyond Wisconsin. I was listening to the radio this morning and the question came up, what will radio be like 25 years from now? Which is kind of if you're in radio, it's an interesting question to ponder. So we will talk about that. And just a reminder that Rhonda Fanning, our producer, who's given us so many extraordinary shows over the past 7.5 years, will have her last day with us on Thursday. So we're going to talk with her a little bit about moments that were unexpected and guests that she's put on the air nobody else would put on the air because they don't do the kind of research she has. So Rhonda will join us for a few moments, too. Reluctantly, I might add, so make her feel welcome. All right, let's go to phone calls, 800-486-8655. Thomas Cahill is our guest, and let's start with Virginia in Janesville. Hi, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi.
I read Witches, Midwives, and Nurses, and it deals with the burning of the women for three generations around this time. And coming up on Halloween, I'm wondering if he dealt with that.
No, I didn't. It isn't really in this period. It really belongs to the 17th century and later. This book starts in the second half of the 14th century and ends in the early 17th century. I don't mean that there never was a witch trial, but there were many of the unfortunately, many of the things that we attribute to the Middle Ages and the earlier Renaissance period really come toward the end of the Renaissance period and into, believe it or not, the period that we associate with you know, the beginnings of democracy and things like that. You know, the Salem witch trials, which is probably the witch trial that we are most familiar with because we're Americans, is much later than the period that I dealt with here. By the end of this period, there is a new and very, very gloomy interest in hell and the devil and temptation and things like that. So the setting is already there for what's going to come next. But the book that you read is really a little bit later than this.
Thanks for the call. Well, here we are almost halfway through the show, and I just wanted to make sure we got to him because you write, and I so agree with you, if any Renaissance artist, or for that matter, any artist in history, is worthy of being approached on one's knees, that artist is Michelangelo, Il Divino, as he was hailed in his lifetime. And I'm so happy that there are, what do you call them? They're more than pictures. They're color, and they're beautiful, and they're in the book, and we got David, and we got the Sistine Chapel, and all of that.
Well, the Sistine Chapel I put in because I thought it has to be there.
Yeah,
but
it does.
What I really say is, look, there's no way of appreciating this in even a much larger art book, and my book is not an art book. You know, even one of those huge art books with double pages and stuff like that. You got to go.
Right, you do.
You got to go and see it. It's the only way. It's one of those few experiences in the world that you just have to you have to be there. And and I urge everyone, if they do nothing else, to show up sometime or plan to show up sometime at the Sistine Chapel. Lie on the floor. If you get there early enough in the day, they'll sometimes let you do that so that you can really look at it. It's just incredible. That you have to say as you look up at it, one human being did this?
Right, right. I didn't know until I read it in your book that he lived to be 89 years old.
Yeah, well, you know, you could say he lived well in the sense that he was very, very hard on himself. He remained very muscular and taut to the end of his life. He scorned people who were pudgy. You know, thought they were just self-indulgent. He was against self-indulgence. He was a Platonist. He was a Plato Augustine kind of guy. And he was very, very hard on himself. And we know, I think, from many other accounts that he fought with the Pope who really made his reputation, Julius II. And they were very different kinds of people. But they were both very ego-centered. They each knew who they were. And boy, they weren't going to move an inch. At one point, as he was doing the ceiling, Julius looked up and, in those days, you didn't tell a pope no. Julius said, well, he thought it was very nice, but all those prophets, he felt that they should have some gold thread in their robes. And Michelangelo said, my lord, they were all poor men. That was the end of that.
Oh, isn't it something, out of all the centuries, and you say Da Vinci was the only one who could come close to his greatness, but that this man was the greatest, that he still so inspires us.
You know, he never wanted to be a painter. He looked down on painters. He didn't, you know, they were just painters, for God's sake. He was a sculptor. That's what he was. And he believed that what you got in a piece of marble was the sculpture was inside it. You just had to chip away and find what was in there. He never wanted to be a painter. And it was Julius who sort of forced him into being a painter. And learning the technique of actually affixing paint to ceiling. Michelangelo was a very quick study. And it's amazing the things that he went on to be an architect. You know, he's responsible for the Dome of St. Peter's, which you can see from everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whenever you look at it, you say, there's Michelangelo.
There he is. And here he is. He's still here.
Yeah.
Just like that guy Shakespeare, you know? They're still here.
Well, he's another one, isn't he?
I know. Let's go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hello. I caught his comment about how we're free now, whereas we used to be serfs, you know? And I think that's kind of like short-sighted, because we're like living in 1984, the movie.
Well, that's what you think.
You don't think we are?
No, of course not. We're not living in 1984. If we were living in 1984, you wouldn't be able to get on the radio and talk to me this way. Come on.
Let's go to Mary. Mary in Madison. Hi.
Yes, hello. I was reading your, haven't finished yet, How the Irish Saved Civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And you speak of Bridget, and I was watching television, and they were talking about the three aspects or faces of Bridget. And does this apply to the other Celtic gods? And
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part. What about the Celtic gods?
Does it apply to other Celtic gods?
Well, Bridget was not a Celtic god. Bridget was an actual human being. She was later confused with one of the Celtic gods, but she was a real woman.
Yes, I know that.
So I don't know. I don't really understand the question, I guess.
What's the question, Mary?
Celtic gods, you talk about them having three forms or three faces. And I know Bridget was a real person, but also there is a Bridget, god of fertility.
Yes. A goddess of, yes, there is an ancient goddess of fertility. Named.
Could you expand on the three faces or forms?
I can't because I didn't talk about three faces or forms in How the Irish Saved Civilization, and I really don't understand the reference.
Well, thanks anyway, Mary. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. What was there about Italy, about certain families who may have supported them, or what had to come for this part of the world to create Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Donatello, the list goes on and on. It's
just
remarkable.
I know. It really is a long list. And I really only have a few of them in there. I mean, there are many, many more. You know, part of what happens in this period, you see the difference. The characteristics of different countries begin to emerge more fully. And what Italy really has right is pleasure. Italy is very good at pleasure. They always have been, and they still are. They're not very good at organizing. And they do get themselves into terrible debt and all sorts of stuff like that, you know, which the Germans would never do. But they're a hell of a lot better than the Germans are at pleasure, and which is why their food is so wonderful and their art is supreme.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that you have very early in this period, in the mid-14th century, really, you have the rediscovery of classical Rome,
mm-hmm.
which quickly leads to the rediscovery of classical Greece. And you have really the rediscovery of the classical period, classical literature, classical art, classical thinking. And the Italians are the first to do that, and they are always ahead of everybody else because they themselves realize this is their own past. This belongs to them.
Mm-hmm.
Cicero belongs to them. And before that, the Greek dramatists belong to them. Plato belongs to them. It is through them that all of that came to the West in the first place. And they're right. And they are very proud of it to such an extent that at first they refused to accept printing, which they considered to be something that had been invented in some barbarian city. Guess who they're talking about? The Germans.
Hmm.
Took them a while to accept that, just as it took the Germans a while to accept the Renaissance. It looked too much fun to them.
It does look like a lot of fun, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and it still is. And also, when you talk about that, the Greco-Roman world, there was a whole tradition of sculpture, too, which had been lost for a long time?
Yeah, it had, because most of it was nude, and the Middle Ages was not a time for nudity. Nudity was rediscovered really by Columbus, because the people who lived in the New World were mostly naked. And that was a big surprise to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody thought that way. And people began to allow themselves to think thoughts they had never thought before, and to make sculptures that hadn't been made in many, many centuries, such as Michelangelo's David.
So who was Columbus? We have a lot of different ideas about who he was and what he was up to. He's included in the book.
Yeah, Columbus is definitely a modern man. There's no two ways about it. But he's a bit of a shyster, you know. He's a bit of a... you know, he's a kind of Willy Loman. He's going around trying to get people to buy this idea of sailing off to the Indies, which he could never have done, and he had most of his figures were wrong, and people knew that, which is why it took so long for him to find a sponsor. He would go from one court to another, and the king or the queen or both of them would turn the matter over to their wise men. The wise men would come back and say, he really doesn't know what he's talking about. And he didn't. If America hadn't been here, he would certainly never have made it to China. It couldn't possibly have happened, because the globe was much larger than he seemed to realize. His figures were off, but he was very charming. He was good-looking, and he did finally succeed in charming Isabella.
Hmm. And Isabella found him charming and good-looking?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Isabella was basically sort of an English woman. I mean, she had blonde hair and blue eyes, and Columbus was red-haired and probably green-eyed or gray-eyed in different reports. And at that period, of course, Ferdinand, her husband, was dark and swarthy, and this was a period in which the crowned heads of Europe were trying to make their progeny more blonde and blue-eyed.
Hmm.
You already have the beginnings of racism mm-hmm. in this period, and especially in Spain.
Let's go to Marianne in Hartford. Hi, Marianne.
Hi. I have had the privilege of reading all of Thomas Cahill's books, and I have been waiting for this one. So I just want to say thank you, Anne, how much I thoroughly enjoy them, and I'm going to go back and read them again.
Well, I
thank
hope
you
enjoy the new one.
Yeah, I'm sure she will. Do you have ones that were more, I don't know, engaging for you? I mean, the whole subject matter, of course, is terrifically engaging. But for me, this particular time period, with some of the all-time greats being alive and creating such masterpieces, would have been one of my favorite times.
Yeah, they're all interesting times, I think. But this was the hardest to write about, let me tell you.
Really? It was? Why?
Yeah. Well, what I found out when I got in the middle of it is that no one writes about the Renaissance and the Reformation in the same book. Even though these things occur at the same time and they hit off against one another, because it's too hard. It's very hard to control the material in such a way that it becomes one story that an individual reader would want to read. But the connection really is what I talked about before, the revival of classicism, because for more than 1,000 years, no one in Western Europe had read the Bible in its original languages, except for scattered communities of Jews who did read the Hebrew Bible in Hebrew. No one knew, no Christians knew Hebrew, and none of them knew Greek, which meant that they were reading even the New Testament in a translation. It's only in this period mm-hmm. that they begin to read the New Testament in the original language, and that's exactly what brings on Luther.
Hmm. And we haven't talked very much about Luther, what kind of person he was, the getting struck by a bolt of lightning, what he was doing in this small town, and how he became such a big deal.
Well, he becomes a big deal by his unwillingness to compromise, his insistence that he cannot give in because his conscience won't allow him to do so. He was a somewhat unyielding person. He was a very, actually, unyielding man. And yet, he also, to an extent, I would say he and Michelangelo are the two great figures that you can't do without in this period.
Mm-hmm.
And they are both unyielding in their different ways. As, you know, I indicated before about Michelangelo, and he wasn't going to give in to the Pope. Well, nor was Luther. Though they're very, very different people, they had many things in common, and they were both extremely pious, prayerful souls.
And Luther thought he was some big sinner. What was he? Why did he think that?
Yeah, because he was what you call, he was scrupulous. I mean, he was overly scrupulous, or it's downright silly looking back on it. At least that's how it looks to me, and I think it would look to most people. Say, oh my God, you know, he starts off as a monk, and he would insist on keeping his confessor in the confessional for 6 hours.
Woo.
To confess all of his sins. And finally, the confessor has really had enough, and he says, Luther, you seem to think every fart is a sin.
Oh.
It is a very German response.
Can you imagine sitting in there for 6 hours listening to somebody who was a
priest? Kneeling there for 6 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, the confessor was sitting probably, but the penitent was kneeling. He was, you would have to say, a real pain in the...
Yeah. Yeah, I gotcha. You write that he first came to public notice as an innovative lecturer on the Bible.
Yeah.
How was he innovative on the Bible?
Well, this is the period in which people are, again, for the first time, reading the New Testament in Greek, and that's what he was doing, and he finally gets to the letters of Paul, and particularly the letter to the Romans, the letter to the Roman community of Paul's time, and there he finds his solution to his dilemma, because he believes that he is not forgiven by God, because he's done all these terrible things, which no one else would think were terrible, but he does. And he finally realizes that, because Paul says, we are forgiven no matter what we did. We're forgiven. Hmm. And Luther makes this connection that, it's not that I have to find a way of being humble enough and repair the damage I've done by my sins, I'm just forgiven. That's all there is to it. Phew. And that's Luther's central insight.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes the insight, the principal insight of the Reformation, as against traditional Catholicism, which said, well, you should do this, you should do this, you should do this. You know, there's a series of steps you should take that the penitent should take, and Luther just says, no, we're forgiven. That's the beginning and the end of it.
Hmm. And when you write that the intellectual assault that he presented against the Catholic Church was so extensive and so well articulated, what did it include, Thomas, the intellectual assault?
It's not only intellectual, it's funny, because Luther did, you know, for all of his neuroses, and he was an extremely neurotic man, he had a very good sense of humor. He had a very German, sort of earthy sense of humor. A lot of the things that he said probably couldn't be said on National Public Radio.
No.
Yeah. You know, you'd have to cut them. Yeah, after I said them, you'd have to cut them out. And when he says those things, he's very funny. You know, he doesn't mind rolling around in the dirt. So he was able to get the Germans on his side because of his particularly German earthiness.
Hmm.
And they said, yeah, man, we're on your side. You know, I mean, it was a lot of it is like that. And, of course, he is also in the period in which printing suddenly is everywhere. Everything that Luther writes is known to everyone
mm-hmm.
within weeks,
hmm.
certainly within Germany, and within Europe, you know, within months.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it isn't the internet, but it's a lot like it for that period. Luther will write a tract, which would have been called a book at the time, though we would think of it as an essay, and it's printed, and it's printed, and it's printed, and it goes all through Germany, and then it's translated on the double, and it goes all through Europe, and people are saying, yay, man, right ahead.
Thomas Cahill is our guest this hour. His latest in the Hinges of History series is Heretics and Heroes, How Renaissance Artists Created Renaissance and, wait a second, How Renaissance Artists and Reformation Priests Created Our World is the full title. You're familiar, I'm sure, with some of his other fine volumes, How the Irish Saved Civilization, The Gifts of the Jews, Mysteries of the Middle East. Here's our phone number if you would like to join the conversation. Are you captivated by this time in history when you think of all of the huge figures who came from this time and the influence they may have on the way that we live now? Who comes to mind? Who is most admired? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. We have an email you can use, and that's talk@wpr.org. Or you can also send us a message on our Facebook page, which we will happily receive, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phone calls for Thomas Cahill in the last minutes of our show. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And before we go to many phone calls that are coming in, Thomas, it was striking to me that you were at some of these places, certainly in Italy, when you were looking at some of the Michelangelo and some of the statues. Do you go to all of these parts of the world and just sort of soak in what's going on and get the feel before you write about it? Or I'm just wondering how you take this huge part of history and put it into a book.
It all depends, Kathleen. You know, I mean, many parts of Europe I've seen over many years. I live part-time in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And more recently, I spend a lot of time in Paris, where our son lives, and it just depends. Sometimes I get there beforehand. Sometimes I get there after I've written the piece, but I go to check to see if it really is what I think it is, and then I'll change it on the basis of that. I would say that I've seen virtually everything. I think I've seen everything I've written about. Yeah.
Hmm. Dave is calling you from Prairie du Sac. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I hardly know where to start. I wondered, first of all, if you could maybe comment briefly on the influence of Erasmus in kind of shaping the arguments of the early Reformation period. And secondly, I wondered if, you know, it seems like in America our cultural identity is heavily identified with the landscape, and I wonder how you feel that the land itself is involved in the development of European cultural identity. And I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there's a chapter in Heretics and Heroes. By the way, all the heretics are heroes. All the heroes are heretics. that's why I called it that. At least to a large extent, that's true. But there's a chapter called On Erasmus and Luther, and it's the connection between the two. And the connection is not that they met, but they did. They had a correspondence. But the real connection is that Erasmus is one of the pioneers of the Greek New Testament in the West. He wrote he put together the main book, the main version of the Greek New Testament that everyone began to read, including Luther. And it was that edition that Luther read and in which he made his discovery, which led to which led directly to the Reformation. Second question.
The landscape, geography.
The landscape is much more difficult. I think, you know, one of the reasons that the American landscape had such a profound impact was that it was unfamiliar and nobody had ever seen it before. Just as in Heretics and Heroes, I show how the discovery of peoples unknown had such an impact on European thought, and in the same way, the landscape of the Americas had a great impact, I think, especially on European Americans of European origin, because it was so very different from anything they were familiar with. But landscape always has an impact. Those Alps that stand between Germany and Italy are a barrier of the mind as much as they are a physical barrier. They make all the difference in the world between those two cultures.
Let's go to Jeff in Madison. Hello.
Yes. I'm wondering, in his book on the Spanish flu of the 20th century, John Barry notes how little art actually emerged from the great epidemic, that epidemic. I'm wondering, what were the real links between the Black Death, the Black Plague, and the Renaissance and the art that emerged up? And I'll listen off the air.
Okay, thanks, Jeff.
I don't think there's any direct connection. I think the Black Death, the bubonic plague, is a precursor of many changes within Europe, especially economic changes and changes in personality. And those then lead to the Renaissance. But there's no direct connection between the plague and the Renaissance. It's a very distant connection, I think.
Mohammed from Cedarburg, hi.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I tuned in late. Very fascinating. You were talking about the Greek Bible and the Vulgate Bible, but my question particularly is to this story of the legend of Pope Joan and how the Reformationist, Reformation scholars and even the later scholars handled the story. It has been in the European legend and something around 900 something or 8. And I just wondered how Reformation scholars and post-Reformation scholars handle the story of Pope Joan.
All right, Mohammed, thank you.
The truth of the matter is they don't handle it. Pope Joan never existed.
Hmm.
It's not to say it's a legend is to give it more dignity than it deserves. There never was a Pope Joan. It's a very late and silly addition, and so you will not find anything about it in conventional or unconventional scholarship. That's it.
Okay. And we only have about a minute and a half left. There's a lot that precedes the major years of the book. You talk about the Easter evening of Easter Monday, dress rehearsals for permanent change, French and the Sicilians, the Vespers, or
yeah.
Boccaccio, or I don't know. Take one of those that you want to talk about in the minute that we have left, because there's a lot before.
Well, it starts with the Sicilian Vespers, about which Verdi wrote a lovely opera. Sicily was then under the thumb of the French, and they hated being in that position. And the Sicilian Vespers was the beginning of a revolution in Sicily, where they got rid of the French. And they also, the Pope was extremely favorable to French oversight of Sicily. It was a real blow to the papacy, which was at that point trying to become not just spiritual master, but physical master of Europe. And that was that really spelled the end of that possibility. It also spelled the beginning of nationalism. The Sicilians, they might not have known that they were yet that they were Italian, but they knew they were Sicilian and they were not French. And they had had enough. That's all there was to it. It's one of the beginnings of national personality that you see and comes to the fore in this period. And these are things that precede the Renaissance and the Reformation.
Mm. Thomas, thank you. I'm so glad this one has been published. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, no, thank you, Kathleen.
Thomas Cahill, and the latest book is Heretics and Heroes, How Renaissance Artists and Reformation Priests Created Our World. As we told you, he is going to be at Boswell Books, and that's going to be a free event on November 7th. It's at 7:30. It should be just a really, can you imagine better conversation, a better evening of conversation than all of what we've talked about and then some? So you're invited to attend that. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program. Tomorrow at 1, Jack Mitchell, former director of Wisconsin Public Radio, about the future of the news media. Rhonda Fanning will join us as well. And at 2, an editor from The Onion, Book of Unknown Knowledge.